Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Back to school season can be both exciting and overwhelming, not just for kids, but parents too. Whether it's the revived bedtime battles, social anxieties, or dread of homework, this transition can feel like a lot. But you know what? Here at State of the Bay, we've got you covered. Tonight, child psychologist Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith joins us with practical advice for managing the emotional ups and downs of the weeks ahead. And later this hour, we'll hear about 13 orphans, Oakland's Mahjong Speakeasy, located in Baba's house. But first, as San Francisco students prepare to return to school next week, the district is navigating one of its most challenging years in recent history. They are facing a $114 million deficit and possible state takeover. And as a result, the district has implemented significant budget cuts, impacting staffing, extracurricular activities, and more. At the same time, SFUSD is rolling out a new math curriculum, revamping its ethnic studies program, and attempting to restore trust after years of payroll issues and leadership turnover. And as if that was not enough, the district, like others across the country, is facing challenges from the Trump administration, including federal funding freezes. So to help us unpack what's ahead for SFUSD kids and families, we're joined by Jill Tucker, longtime education reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jill.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, so first, let's start with the district's budget deficit. It's $115 million, as we mentioned. What cuts have been made, and how close is the district to balancing the books?
Yeah, I think a lot of staff and principals and others would say what cuts have not been made. But it is a lot of cuts to staffing. It is, so we have seen cuts at the schools, at the district office, across basically every department in the district, and so it is a lot of people, positions, and programs, and so there are a lot of families will probably notice a lot of things that are not there. It may take a lot longer to get phones answered at the district office, things like that this year. $114 million is about 10% of the district's budget. So it's a lot that they have cut. And so I think we're definitely going to see that. They do have a balanced budget at this point. So that is the good news for this upcoming year. But in the outgoing years, next year and the year after, they still have cuts to be made. So it's not over yet, even though they're in the black for this upcoming year.
I mean, the reporting that you have has at least 314 educators being cut from the staff, whether that was voluntary layoffs or people's jobs being lost. I mean, that really is going to affect the classroom experience. What's the district telling parents at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are saying that this is necessary. The other option is to go into fiscal insolvency and a state takeover. So it really is a choice between two evils, really. But they, you know, the choice really, it's not a choice. Fiscal insolvency is really not the choice. So on the plus side, you know, they talk about right-sizing the district. They haven't made the cuts to address the declining enrollment that they've had in the past. So they've really been trying to right-size classrooms, the number of students with the teachers. So even though you will see the loss of these positions, really they're trying to get the class sizes to be right-sized with the number of teachers. But, you know, really it is a loss of things like reading intervention teachers and coaches. Things like that are quote unquote extras, which, you know, if you talk to principals, they will say, and other teachers, those aren't extras, right? But they are, you know, we're really down to classroom teachers. We're really down to the basics when you're looking to cut that much money from a school budget or from a district budget. So, yeah, it's a lot of people gone at the central office, as I said, you know, and the kind of beloved people at a school that might be that one person that the kids look up to that might not be there this year because they aren't the quote unquote necessities that you might, you know, that are just the ones in the classroom, the teacher in the classroom.
A year ago, we talked to the then superintendent of the school district, and the big topic was closing schools. And there was a lot of controversy about whether that would happen, which schools were on the list. Is the district still considering closing schools in order to manage its budget?
You know, definitely not this year. I talked to Superintendent Maria Sue recently, and what she told me was this is a year to get stability in the district, financial stability, get the payroll system stable, get hiring stable. The district really can't move forward with those really hard conversations like closing schools and things like that until they can get their financial feet on solid ground and get, we all remember the payroll fiasco. Mm-hmm. They have their new payroll system online. I'm just finishing a story. They still have some bugs. They still have some errors, but they are moving forward with that new payroll system. They need to get that settled. They need to stop having the hiring fiascos that they had last year. And so what she really wants to see is a stable district financially and all of these other systems issues, organizational issues, and then the district can move forward. So I do not expect to see any conversations about closures in this next year. I think everybody can kind of exhale and go back to school and deal with sort of these cuts and what we're seeing without having all of that happen as well.
You know, when we see cuts like this, parents just want to pitch in. They want to help teachers. They want to help staff. And there's been some frustration among parents about new restrictions on how PTAs can fund staff at their schools. What's the policy and what's driving that policy?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a weird policy. It's heartbreaking a little bit because people do want to donate. They want to backfill some of these losses. What that is there are some places, PTAs, that want to fund positions, specifically maybe backfill some teaching positions, or in one case, the PTA had hired additional Mandarin immersion teachers because it helped keep class sizes lower, right? Hmm. And so, but the district has a hiring freeze for things like that because they want to make sure that they fill all the basic classroom teaching positions before they are able to fill these extra positions, right? They don't mm-hmm. want teachers to go into these extra positions that are funded by PTA or other types of things until they fill the most basic classroom positions. And so every position is being vetted by the state fiscal expert to make sure that they're all needed, that they're all required. But even if there's this extra money from a PTA or somewhere else, the district has this policy that until 95% of classroom positions, the necessary ones, every first grade classroom has a teacher, every classroom, that they're not going to allow these other positions to be filled. So it is frustrating for parents that they, when they raise this money, that they in the past have been able to fill these positions that they want, and now they can't.
Hmm. You know, again, going back to last year's conversation with Matt Wayne, the former superintendent, one of the issues the district was having was actually hiring teachers and finding people qualified to teach in the classrooms. And now we're seeing the cuts to these positions. Is hiring, I mean, it doesn't sound like there's going to be a hiring problem, but does that a lack of teachers to hire, is that still a problem right now, or it's just not for this district?
No, it still is. We still have a teacher shortage across the state and across in many parts of the country. So even though we've had a lot of these buyouts, early retirement, even layoffs in many places, we still have a teacher shortage, especially in many areas like special education and math and science. There is still a difficulty in hiring teachers, and it's very competitive. So you have districts that are paying more, that maybe don't have some of the issues that other urban districts have. And so it can be very difficult for districts like San Francisco to fill all their classrooms. That doesn't mean that it's difficult for all subject areas or all grade levels, but it is difficult for certain for certain schools, certain subject areas to fill those classrooms, for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit of maybe some interesting or happier news, which is, okay, the SFUSD is rolling out a new K through 8 math curriculum. Those are the kinds of things that make parents excited to hear about new math. Why the change, and what will the curriculum be like?
Yeah, I went to the training where teachers were getting the training on this new math curriculum. It's the first new curriculum for math in about 16 years. So as you can imagine, technology has changed a lot in those 16 years. There's a lot of new stuff out there for teachers to use. They were very excited about this new math curriculum. I mean, it's still math. Kids are still going to learn math, but they're going to have a lot of new materials to use. The new curriculum comes with a lot of digital games and digital resources, and including, which is really cool, resources for parents where they can go online and look at what the kids are learning and how they're learning. And there's videos, because I know there's a lot of parents out there that remember when Common Core came online or new math, kids brought home their homework and they had no idea what the kids were learning or how they could help them. It was very frustrating for a lot of parents. And so there's a lot of resources for them, but really, the math curriculum, it's sort of, they described it as a three-legged stool where you have the foundational math. You know, it's still looking, you know, multiplication, division, you know, looking at fractions. How do you do that? Decimals, all of those basics. But then it's also the why and when, which I think a lot of us who decades ago, we learned how to do the math, but we never really learned when or why we needed it. And so we sort of grew up in this vacuum of, I never really used that math. And that's what they're trying to solve here, is give these kids that why and when, so that as they grow up and go into the world in college, that they have an idea of what that math is for, and have much more of an idea that it is fun, it's interesting. And so what I heard from a lot of the teachers when they were learning this new curriculum was that it's fun. And that when they piloted it, the kids, they thought it was fun, that math was fun. And so that idea that you're hearing from kids, that math is fun, I think that bodes well for the new curriculum, or at least that's what the district officials and teachers are telling me. So fingers crossed that leads to better test scores and that we have a new generation of kids that are not math phobes.
Well, I certainly hope that is the case. I certainly could have used those videos myself when my kids
Same.
Were this age.
Yes.
There's, well, Jill, there's so much more we could have talked about, but we're going to have to leave it there. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about what's happening at the district.
Thank you. I hope everybody has a great school year and that it's a calm school year. That is my wish for myself and everyone else.
Mine too. Well, thanks so much. That was Jill Tucker, education reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Coming up next after this very short break, we'll hear back to school tips from child psychologist and mother Allison Briscoe Smith. Stay with us.
I'm Lynn Wintergross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with advice from experts in the field.
Our next episode is all about planning for the future. We'll talk about the benefits of downsizing, why everyone needs a will, and how to stay a step ahead of scammers. Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
This is Eli Wirtschafter from Uncuffed. We teach radio and podcasting inside prisons. We bring you stories you can't hear anywhere else and give people skills that help them re-enter into society. It's a public service for you and our community. Congress is cutting KALW's funding. We can't rely on federal support anymore, so we need to count on you. Make a monthly donation at kalw.org to keep this public service going. Stand with KALW. Thank you.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Well, as we've said, it's that time again. Backpacks are reappearing, pencils are being sharpened, kids and parents are gearing up for the big shift back to school. But, you know, let's be honest, transitions aren't always easy, especially after a summer of late nights, more relaxed routines, and maybe, just maybe, a little too much screen time. Tonight, I'm joined by child psychologist Allison Briscoe-Smith to talk about how parents can ease the transition for kids and for ourselves. We'll get into everything from sleep hygiene to friendship dynamics, anxiety about returning to class, even how to talk with our kids when tough stuff comes up. Whether your child is starting kindergarten, prepping for college, Allison's got tips for making this season feel a little more manageable. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Allison.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. And State of the Bay listeners, we're opening up our phone lines tonight to hear from you. What's coming up for you and your family right now when it comes to back to school? We'd love to hear about your successes and your struggles as the first day of school approaches, or maybe school has already started. I know that's the case for some districts. So tell us how it's going. You can join us by calling 866-798 8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. You can find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. And here's a treat. You'll also be hearing more from Allison in the months ahead. She'll be stepping in to guest host State of the Bay from time to time. We'd love to know what parenting topics you'd like her to dig into. So send us your ideas and your questions. So, Allison, let's start with the basics. When it comes to back to school, I'm sure you hear a lot from parents and kids. What are some of the typical challenges families face during this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think you named a lot of them, and we can also just pay attention to the conversation that we just had. Like, you know, schools are challenged in this particular moment. There's a lot kind of going on, from math curriculum to funding to all of that. So usually what I'm hearing is overwhelm. And a little bit of panic about kind of making a big transition. People often feel like, how did this happen all of a sudden? Mm-hmm. What are the things that I have to kind of do and prepare for? And also, on the other hand, is like, we do this every year, right? So, but it does feel like there's a lot that people are just stressed and overwhelmed by in this big transition.
You know, one of the things about the school year, and I think that gives people anticipatory dread, is how busy it can become. You know, the kids, if you have kids, they probably have an extracurricular activity, whether that's a sport or club or a job. And, you know, parents themselves are busy. They work and they've got their own issues that they need to attend to. So how can parents prevent overscheduling without feeling their child is missing out?
Yeah, I mean, one of these kinds of pieces that you've talked about, we actually see kind of in the data over time, is that this is something that has changed over time. That maybe the ways in which you were parented or I was parented was, yes, there was busyness, but it's simply not as much as what we're seeing Gen Z and Gen Alpha kids. So number one, let's recognize that the kind of demands upon our time and our scheduling, whether it's from scheduling that play date to that tutor to... it's different now. It is a lot. So step one, recognize it's a big ask. I think step two, we got to prioritize. We cannot do all of the things. That's one of my major kind of mantras in kind of parenting. We can't do all of the things. We can't be in all of the different places. So we need to take just a little bit of kind of preventative time to figure it out. And maybe that's week by week. This week, we're going to prioritize getting to this rehearsal or getting to this activity. Or maybe the priority is, this is a week of transition. We're not going to make all of the extracurriculars, and that's okay. But we're going to have to narrow it down and pick one, because the demands on our time and the ask have gotten larger.
Mm. I mean, I remember at this time when I had younger kids, my little tip was, I always put in my calendar in April, May is extremely busy, say no. Mm-hmm. I had that
very
show up
wise,
every day. And I think it's a matter of, as you said, picking and choosing. I mean, for the child who wants to do everything, should you say, maybe you need to pare that down? Like, should you step in, whether that child is in junior high or high school or even younger?
It's a great conversation to have, because let's think about it this way. We are getting them ready for life. And in life, we're not able to do all of the things. Like, maybe we sometimes try, but I think we all know that there are consequences to that. So sometimes it feels like, am I being overbearing? Am I telling them no? Let's reframe that. This is a conversation that they need to have, whether it's 4, 5, 6, or getting ready for college. What are our priorities? What can we make? Think of this as an opportunity for us to do that development with them, to help them think about it, as opposed to some sort of top-down kind of harsh consequence. No, this is a conversation for stuff that we need to prepare ourselves for in the future.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about easing the transition from summer to school with child psychologist Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith, and we'd love to hear from you. How is back to school going in your household? What are the issues that you're wrestling with right now? Or do you have any tips on how to manage the school year and manage this transition? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. This is your chance to get your question answered by a top-notch child psychologist. So definitely give us a call, 866-798-8255. Well, we're already getting some questions, and I just want to go into those, Allison. And the first question is, of course, about technology, and it's this. What's your advice on when to give your child access to tech? I feel like my parent cohort is starting to see the dangers of phones, but so many of the 11 to 12-year-olds in my child's cohort are getting phones. What's your advice?
Yeah, this is a big and hot topic. And so one thing is to just recognize, as this person is saying, there's what's going on with their parenting cohort, there's what's going on with their kids' cohort. There are a lot of different places that you can get lots of information about this, and maybe almost too much information. One of the things that we have to kind of figure out and we have to kind of come back to is, what do I think? Really, when I'm not thinking about what is somebody else doing or what should I do, but what do I think? What are the needs of my particular family? What are the needs and how do I want to think about what my child might need? I think that's the biggest place. It's really hard to kind of tune out all the information and the data that's kind of coming to folks. And I really want to encourage folks, you just got to think a little bit, what does my kid particularly need? Do they need access to technology or pieces of technology to negotiate their spaces and be safe? Are you worried about them not kind of engaging socially? Well, let's think about what are the opportunities. So it's not just all or none. I think it's really thinking about, what does my kid need? What do I believe? And making slow choices about that, as opposed to everybody else seems to be doing it or everyone else isn't doing it. We got to think about, what does this mean for myself and my kid?
You know, in response to that, you know, there are some kids out there who will just nag and just say, I want a phone. I want a phone. I want a phone. Why can't I have a phone? Why? And they just, you know, they keep at it. And how do you deal with that? I'm not speaking from personal experience, but, you know, I mean, when you get this constant onslaught of wanting something, even when you've said very clearly, that's not happening.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to bet that children that do that are doing that in other spaces too. And I'm also going to say that's because they're kids. Just because we have a very rational, well-reasoned, well-supported boundary doesn't mean they're not going to push on it. So, you know, sometimes we think, well, maybe I'm wrong or maybe I didn't. It's okay to set that boundary. But what kids are supposed to do is they're supposed to push on it. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be strong and you've got to hold it. And, you know, if you're amenable to changing your mind, think about why and when. And so that's another kind of place. We can't pick a firm boundary in all of the things. I think many of us as parents try to. I'm going to have a fight about, you know, what's on the dinner table or what's being worn or how they come into the house. We got to pick a thing. Otherwise, we become overwhelmed. And we also have to pick and prioritize which is most important. If the phone or the screen time is a big deal for us, stick with that. Stick with it. But they're supposed to fight us.
That's so funny. I mean, sometimes our kids are fighting with us, but sometimes we're fighting with our co-parent or, you know, our spouse when it comes to parenting. And, you know, one parent might be a little bit more chill on a certain topic than the other. And I noticed, you know, as I've watched people raise kids, that it's often the friction between the parents that can be just as exhausting and tiring. What's your advice on how parents can make sure that, you know, the kids don't divide and conquer or that they're on the same page?
Yeah, because the kids will divide and
conquer. Oh, yeah, for sure. for sure.
And again, that's, I want to kind of frame that as not like bad child behavior. Mm. It is child behavior. Mm. And if they're actually kind of seeing us not be coordinated with our co-parent, then why wouldn't they go to where they want to be able to meet their need? So you said something I think is important, which is like, we got to take the time to be on the same page. Now, that takes work. We might not agree. So again, we've got to pick, okay, this is something that's really, really important. I need to stand on this, and here's why. And we need to be able to kind of communicate that in a kind of a common way. We're not going to be on the same page about every single thing. So then again, we've got to figure out which ones are okay to kind of let go slide and which ones aren't. People get into trouble when everything is 100 out of 100. And that just doesn't work for our negotiation and for what kids are kind of hearing. So it's prevention. I got to have the conversation with my co-parent and got to figure out where are we going to draw some lines and how do we think about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good advice. And I would say for my own parenting, like my husband and I would try to have a weekly check-in just to talk through where we had drawn the line and also make sure that we didn't say yes to something unless we said, what did your dad say about that? Or what did your mom say about that? Just to make sure that we weren't being divided and conquered, although we often were. I mean,
yeah, we must have smart children. I like that idea about like, and if it is possible, right, to
yes.
think about the co-parent or the people that are parenting with us,
mm-hmm.
15 minutes a week.
Yeah.
And also, maybe that line that I drew back then needs to be shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it needs to be altered. Maybe we can kind of do something. But, you know, to pick a line at the beginning of the new year, we're going to need some flexibility. This is a big transition. Things are going to change. That thing that I thought was important isn't. So the opportunity to just touch base just a little bit, reconnect, goes a really long way for giving kids the security and the communication that they really need.
You know, and I think more now than in any other time, the difference between how the parents were raised and the situation around them to what their kids are experiencing, it's just, there's such a vast divide. I mean, these kids are growing up with so much technology, so much information that a lot of parents didn't have. I mean, I was surprised by how much coordination I had to do for my kids because, you know, when I was growing up, you just go next door to have a play date and not have to be their concierge. So how do you navigate, like, the only time I remember as being a child was when I was a child and those expectations of like, well, it was this way when I was a kid, so it should be this way for my kid. Is that something you see in your practice? And what do you counsel? How do you counsel people who are struggling with that?
All the time I see that tension kind of come up, which is like twofold. One of which is like, this is the way that it works for me, so I'm going to do it.
Mm.
Or I often work with parents who they themselves had really, really hard childhoods.
Mm.
And so instead, well, this is what happened to me, so I'm going to go the opposite way. And it sometimes leaves us all kind of in a place of not really kind of understanding and not parenting in the ways that we really want to. So what I would kind of encourage us to do, and I think you pointed the way towards that, is like the context in which our children are growing up is fundamentally different than the ways that we did. But that's been true for all of parenting. Generations change, things that go, you know, move over time, TV, electricity, all of those kinds of things. But we have an opportunity to actually to listen to our kids about what their experiences are like. You know, to ask, like, what are you watching? what does that meme mean? Like, for us to demonstrate our curiosity and to kind of learn and to even think with them about the risk and the challenges demonstrates our interest and gives us the information, as opposed to coming with zero information and just dropping the hammer on something that we don't understand. So there's an opportunity, and I think even the frame that you provided, let's recognize that A, our children are not ourselves, and B, that they're growing up in some place different that I might need to have the humility to learn about. And the last kind of piece is, that still means, though, that I can want my children to be safe or respectful or kind, that those are things that we have, you know, for generations as well. It might be that the kindness conversation looks different if we're talking about ghosting a friend on Snapchat versus, you know, what it was like when you didn't knock on the door of your neighbor. But kindness is still there. We just might have to listen to them about what's going on in this current, you know, current time.
Well, here's another question from a listener. I loved school. I couldn't wait to get back, but I have a kid who dreads it, this kid finds it exhausting, boring, stressful. How do I help my kid navigate this transition and make the best of this? I think my kiddo is a little bit of an Eeyore, so maybe I just accept the way it is?
I mean, I love the question because in part it's doing some listening and distinguishing about I liked school, but my kid doesn't. And leaving open some space for, like, I want to get curious about why that's true. Also, there's this piece about kind of understanding, like, maybe this is a kid that doesn't get excited about much. It might be kind of a personality space or a trait. So there's some distancing that I think allows from some space that this kid could kind of negotiate things. I would want to do some deep listening about what does the kid get excited about? Where are those kinds of spaces? What does feel good? And to listen to see where that's possible within the school day, but then also to try to teach the child to listen for that as well. Can we pay attention to what is working? What is feeling good? Is it a matter of like getting through the school day to do something that you like afterwards? There are ways of helping the kid and any of us to kind of pay attention to what's working for us that, again, is a valuable life skill. So I wonder if there's a way to kind of talk to the kid about, okay, where is this space? What does make you light up? What does work?
Yeah. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about how kids and parents can make the back-to-school transition go more smoothly, and we're joined by child psychologist and parent Allison Briscoe-Smith. We'd love to hear your questions. How are your kids handling this transition? What's working for you? What's driving you crazy? Join us by calling 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on socials. Allison, things are pretty heavy right now in terms of what's happening in the world. Pick a topic and it's not great news. How do we help kids, you know, navigate that, whether they actually know what's going on or they get that feeling that, gosh, the adults around me are feeling a little heavy emotionally?
Right. I think one thing we need to attend to is that kids are picking up on what's going on. I wouldn't say necessarily that young kids or maybe some other kids are knowing the details, but if we are distressed or we are overwhelmed as parents and caregivers, then our kids are going to notice. So I think sometimes we're in a space of like, well, maybe they just don't know what's going on. The other thing I would really encourage is get curious about how children are making sense about what's going on in the world around them. What are you hearing? What do you think? Who, you know, what stories have you heard about what's kind of going on here, there, and other kinds of spaces? Get curious. The third thing I would recommend is a lot of parents kind of come to me thinking about, like, well, how do I talk about this particularly difficult thing? And I'm going to ask people, you know, what do you want to communicate? What do you want to say? And that can even be, you know what, I don't know how to think about this big thing that's going on, but I know it's important. So, you know, take some time to figure out what's going on for your child. How are they understanding? Ask lots of questions because you might be jumping in with an assumption. But then you're going to also need to do the work to figure out, what do I really think about this? What do I really want to tell my child about this? And that, how do I want them to have a sense of kind of maybe agency around, especially when we're thinking about things that feel like they're out of our control or just really, really bad? We need to give kids some sort of sense of agency. And that agency can be, so we're going to read about it. We're going to learn about it. We're going to talk about it. We're going to go out and do this activity. The agency is really important for kids and for ourselves as well.
I love how it's this idea of shared curiosity. And, you know, you're advising that we give the kids agency, but we're also supporting them through that. They can lead the conversation, but we're there to answer questions, which I think is such a lovely way to handle these tough things. Here's another question from a listener who writes, I have a kid entering junior year of high school, which is a tough one academically. They go to a competitive public high school. How do I help my older kid manage increasing expectation, theirs and those around them, especially as they think about college? I don't want to add pressure and anxiety to the situation, but I do want my kids to do well. I just don't want this to be a pressure cooker for them. A lot baked into that.
Yeah, there's a lot there, right? So there's some fascinating new research coming out of the Common Sense Media space that actually asks young people around this kind of age, like, what are the pressures? And the pressures really are this, the pressure to already have it all figured out, meaning like their career and what they're doing in schools, the pressure to have a side hustle, meaning the to earn money or to actually run that nonprofit so I can be, you know, marketable to a school, and the pressure to be really good friends. So I think it's really interesting. Kids are managing a lot, and they're managing a lot with pressure. So first thing I would say is that this parent is wise to know that this is a hard time. We need to kind of lean into that and not try to minimize that it's not. One of the things that we can do is we can give kids the information like, gee, this is rough. There's a lot going on. We can also partner with our kids to help prioritize. Hey, this is our chance to learn how to develop the muscle of managing stress. Let's try this on. Let's see, you know, what's our schedule like? What can we do? How do we manage stress when we don't get a good grade on that test? Or if we're worried about how things are going to kind of happen, if you've got one of these kind of high anxious, high pressure kind of kids. To turn this into an opportunity for learning takes the pressure down a little bit and gives them a little bit of a sense that everything is not going to be ruined or terrible. That's when I see kids who feel like so overwhelmed that they feel like they can't kind of get out of it. If we reframe this as that this is our growth mindset, our opportunity to learn, it doesn't take away from, oh, you'll be fine. It actually lets us lean into the space of this is tough. Let's learn together.
Yeah, and it is so tough because I feel like with it in something about the Bay Area and, you know, this idea, when you even just said it, it's like you have to have great grades, good test scores, you have to found your own nonprofit, you need a side hustle. I mean, that feels just like an adult's life in some ways. That we would expect that from a 16 or 17-year-old just feels really wrong.
Yeah. And so we're hearing this and seeing this. I'm sure many folks in the spaces are probably nodding their heads with kind of seeing this. We also can hold that there are many experiences across the board. But when we look into this kind of high pressure, we have to understand that what kids are looking for is an opportunity to grow and develop and to live. But if we only tell them this is the only way to do it, they get a little stuck. And so we also, as parents, as communities, can push back against that there and show the opportunities of people who are living and thriving and making different choices in our kind of communities that didn't have to do things a particular quote unquote right way. It's not the right way for everybody.
Yeah.
So there are things that we can do. And then we also need to be thoughtful about what are we modeling for our kids as well. You know, how are we living and thriving as well for our kids? Because they're learning from us too. So no pressure there to be perfect parents. No, but just we can even narrate, gee, like I ended up in this space and I'm working so hard. And sometimes that's not the best. We can narrate. We can talk to them about it.
I wanted to recommend a book. I don't know if you've read it. It's called Never Enough by Jennifer Wallace. And I thought that was such a helpful book in the sense that it was talking about this particular period in a kid's life and a parent in a family's life and just letting the kids know it's like what matters is them. What the outcome is not as important as them. So it's a nice way to deal with it. Here's another, question that I have. And I think a lot of parents have this regardless of what age their kids are, which is how can you check in with your kid such that you get more than fine, okay, good, boring as an answer, and instead of making it feel like an interrogation, to understand what's going on in the world. When they're little, you know, sometimes you can only get a one word answer about how school was, and when they're older, you just might even just get a shut door.
Yeah. This is also a really tough one. I think, you know, if you can establish habits of communication early, you know, like we at every dinner have a check-in, you know, and even if it's one word, at least it's something, it's a regular kind of pause, or build in kind of opportunities. I know a lot of people don't like the long drives to the sports and all of that, but I also hear from so many parents, it's the only time we talk. You know, making it all the way to volleyball practice is the only time when we talk. So pay attention to what habits you are creating for people, for you as a family to kind of talk. Model it for yourself as well. Tell them about how your day was. Tell them about something that was funny or something, you know, or, you know, I was really struggling with this coworker. Modeling those habits is really important. The second kind of piece is to understand that developmentally, it is completely appropriate for especially our teens and tweens to not have anything to say to us. So that's tough. That doesn't feel good. We have to think that's what's happening in teens and tweens, is that they are getting ready to individuate, to separate, to move from us psychologically, you know, physically sometimes. And that type of move sometimes requires quietness or keeping things to themselves. So that's
or quiet surliness.
Yeah, not my favorite. But again, to kind of frame, okay, this may not be that something really, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean something bad is going on. It just means that development is going on. But if there are ways of creating, modeling places and habits of communication, that can be a place that you can kind of rest on as kids get older.
On this topic of kids getting older, we have another listener question, a lot here. I'm a parent sending a kid off to college. What are some ways I can stay connected to them while also letting go? My advice, don't show up and like try to sleep on their dorm floor. I mean, don't be a smother mother.
Right. That's tough. So part of it is doing the kind of internal work. First, what does being connected mean for me? What would I want in terms of being connected? We have to do that thinking, because I think what ends up happening in the transition is a whole lot of acting out around it instead of clarity around it. So, you know, what is it that I would really want and what I would really need? And then let's also hear from the kid that's going off to college. What do they really want and really need? And I think oftentimes we're kind of, you know, in a place of worry. What if they need help? Okay, let's clarify. If you need help, this is how we'll talk to each other. Hmm. Maybe it's a matter of like, actually, our predominant form of communication is through memes. Fine. But I just want to know that I get a couple memes from you a week. You know, we have to have kind of a contract for communication that starts in this kind of transition. And I do think that we're going to have to be, you know, many of us are going to have to acknowledge that our desires for communication aren't going to match what they need or want. Mm-hmm. And that's why we grieve a little. That's why we struggle a little. That's why we have a hard time.
It's a hard time. I mean, I know some people call it empty nesting, and I know other people call it free birding. You know, it's kind of just depends on your sensibility on that. Well, I mean, Allison, as we look at these transitions, I mean, transitions in any form of any part of life are hard, whether you move or a new job or loss of a loved one. Transitions are tough. So are there some tried and true ways or thoughts about transitions that you have as you advise kids and families?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways I like to kind of think about it, and I think you kind of named it. One of which is to identify and to recognize that transitions are disruptive. They are challenging, and they're often challenges to belonging that happen. So one of which is challenges to belonging and transitions are normal. Number two, they are temporary. This won't last forever. Right. And then the other piece is to remind ourselves of the other transitions that we have been through, the ways that we have survived and are resilient through other kind of transitions, and bring those to bear now. So I think the trick, though, is sometimes reminding ourselves, here we are, another transition. I forgot. So it's a transition. They are hard. They are challenging. They don't last forever. And I've been through stuff before. Maybe not the same one, but I've been through stuff before. And there's some great research and support around these kinds of ideas too.
It's such good advice. And I cannot wait for you to be on State of the Bay more, because I could have talked to you for 3 hours. I think we need to grab coffee.
Yes, likewise, for sure.
Tonight's guest was Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith. She's going to be on State of the Bay more often. So everybody should listen in, because it's words of wisdom you are getting from Allison. Thanks again for joining us tonight, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And coming up after the break, we have more about Oakland's Mahjong Speakeasy. Get those tiles washed. Get the dim sum ready. It's a good time. Stay tuned.
I'm your host, Jeff Shackman. This week on the California Sun podcast on KALW, we'll understand why California leads the nation in everything. We'll look at what might happen to the future of BLM lands. We'll see how ghost students are enrolling in our community colleges. And we'll learn how anchor outs have become the new homeless. That's the California Sun this week at 11:30 a.m. on KALW.org and 91.7 FM, San Francisco.
I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
And I'm Miriam Goodman. We are the hosts of Not Born Yesterday. Our show explores the joys and challenges of aging with advice from experts in the field.
Our next episode is all about planning for the future. We'll talk about the benefits of downsizing, why everyone needs a will, and how to stay a step ahead of scammers. Join us Monday at 7 p.m. for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Hey, I'm Charlotte Kay. The Bay Area is such an amazing melting pot of cultures, so I'm delighted to share unique beats from the world streets. Join me every Monday from 10 p.m. to midnight here on KLW San Francisco Bay Area 91.7 FM.
If you thought Mahjong was just for Chinese grandmothers, think again. The pastime with ancient origins is having a moment, across the country and right here in the Bay Area. Young mothers are forming clubs. It's a favorite in retirement homes, and even celebrities are hooked. Earlier this year, Julia Roberts told Stephen Colbert how she unwinds.
Do you have any things that like you do to like to relax you?
I do. Well, I play Mahjong with my girlfriends once a week.
That endorsement makes it official. Mahjong is a thing. And if you're looking for a fun, social way to learn and play, there's a new spot you should know about. 13 Orphans is a Mahjong speakeasy that opened this spring in Oakland. I dropped by on a recent Friday night to check it out.
As you continue into the main Mahjong den now, we've got, you know, 3-4 Mahjong tables up at any time. Some of them are your regular green ones that fold up and have the edges on them. Some of them are your 4-footers, but we have all different kinds of Mahjong mats laid about with different sets offered from our families. They've been donated. I think very few of them are actually bought by us.
That was Alan Chen. He's one of the co-founders of 13 Orphans, along with his fiance, Jen Louie. Jen explains how their original space, a small snack shop called Baba's House, started.
My dad actually, he passed away in 2020, and Baba's House actually kind of came about because of his passing. It sparked something in me to create something for the community and like a love letter, kind of how my dad was very community-oriented.
Baba's House quickly became a neighborhood hub for food, music, and cultural events.
We were kind of always like a little tucked in speakeasy something, like either a snack shop or a community events space. And Mahjong was one of the earlier programmings that we did, along with nights of DJ programming or live jam sessions, comedy night, Cantonese club. So we do a lot of cultural and like community-based events here.
It was a little bit of everything, but the through line was the focus on community.
I think what has been really cool is, especially from the beginning, what Baba's House really stemmed from were events that we hosted or collaborated on with artists from the community.
That's Eman Garcia, an early partner who rejoined the team last year. He describes how Baba's House evolved into a gathering place for musicians.
We started jam sessions because Alan himself is a musician and he was bringing in his musician friends. He would find out that there were certain customers who also played various instruments, and that's how that event launched.
And for visual artists, too.
And then we also know a lot of different artists with a variety of mediums. And through that, we launched the art gallery that we now have upstairs. We actually have an artist on display right now, and we rotate that quarterly.
When the downstairs restaurant became available, the team decided to rethink the space. They were testing the water, seeing what the community wanted.
Last year, we had the opportunity to take over the restaurant downstairs, and that's when we kind of hit the reset button and kind of reformatted in the sense of like, okay, who are we now?
And what the community wanted was more Mahjong.
Why don't we really focus in on the tried and true, which is Mahjong, which our community loves. And it seems like more and more people are, it's piquing their interest.
Not only was Mahjong a favorite with their patrons, but each of them has a personal connection with the pastime.
I think what's really cool is, given the difference in our backgrounds, Jen being Chinese, Cantonese, Alan Taiwanese, and myself being Filipino, I think it's really cool that there's this intersection where this game has just been really prevalent, even with our different upbringing.
Jen remembers it from her childhood.
Ever since, I don't even remember, like a little girl, my parents would play every single weekend.
It's part of Alan's past too, but with a caveat.
When I was a kid, I would go up and ask my parents, hey, can I learn to play Mahjong? And they would just simply say, no, don't gamble. And that was the end of the story, and they would shoo me away.
So bringing Mahjong into the space wasn't just nostalgic. It had a deeper personal meaning.
When you sit down at a Mahjong table, the Cantonese culture part of it, Cantonese culture that I've learned through Jen, is very sassy by nature. And so when you sit across from somebody and you bring that sassiness, it's hard just to sit around and have a boring game. You connect in some way because it breaks barriers just to talk to each other in that way, just to challenge each other through the game. So in that way, I'm really thankful for almost like being offered a chance to reclaim my culture in a way through the game of Mahjong.
But Mahjong is only half the formula. 13 Orphans is also a speakeasy, and that experience has been just as thoughtfully curated. Jen creates the drinks, which she calls tea tales.
So it's tea-based along with inspiration from traditional Chinese medicine. So you'll see a lot of Chinese herbs that's placed in the drinks, and they're each drink is inspired by like a element of Chinese medicine.
Like the Mahjong, the drinks are inspired by their culture and their past.
So the Hawthorn Dragon is kind of, from my childhood, I used to eat those Hoth Flakes, which is made of hawthorn berries, water, and something else. And like, they're just little discs. But I've never seen it anywhere else. I never knew of what really that it was a berry, of all things, really. And then as I learned more about it, I'm like, oh, it's kind of cool. So when we create the cocktail, there's a play of like nostalgic flavors. It's got a little spiciness from the ginger and a Szechuan like salt. So it's a little tangy, savory, and sour. It just kind of plays with your senses, so it makes it a little more fun.
The food also draws on memory and culture. Iman is the chef.
Every time I create a dish, I'm literally reading cookbooks, watching YouTube videos on the history of it, how it fits into Chinese culture, what the Filipino version of it, regional variations of each one are. And I really try to do things that pay homage to all of that, but also are just really fun. I tell people that the food that I make is not necessarily authentic, but it's authentic to my experience as a first-gen Filipino-American growing up here.
And it's delicious. Whether you're in the speakeasy sipping a tea tail or in the main room around a Mahjong table, the energy is warm and welcoming. When I visited, there were regulars and newcomers, young and old.
We've seen like someone bringing their mom playing, and then someone that's sitting here that's a stranger that's like 20-something year old.
That's exactly what I saw. I played around with beginners in their 20s, then chatted with a woman who was a bit older. She's a regular.
I got into Mahjong and I wanted to figure out where I could play. And then I discovered these folks on Instagram and now I'm here like a couple times a week.
I also met a group of men who come every week. Jen, Alan, and Iman have created a space that feels like home.
I have memories of my aunties hosting games where they're playing with their neighbors or a friend they met at the supermarket or someone from their church. We've seen that happen here where we have groups of people who have met each other just through playing Mahjong here and they continue to connect here at the shop. And I think it's really amazing to see that.
Maybe that's why Mahjong is having a moment.
That's one of the beautiful things about the game. That's one of the beautiful things about the community here too. People feel very welcome just to sit down, you know, tap somebody on the shoulder, say, hey, can I sit with you guys? Can I play a game?
In today's world, we could all use a place like that. To learn more about 13 Orphans or plan a visit, go to babashouse.com. We'll also include a link on the State of the Bay page at kalw.org. This is Chris Nooney for State of the Bay.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. And honestly, who doesn't want a little mahjong and dim sum? That sounds awesome. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll hear from master storyteller John Aubert. He's going to tell us about crafting stories that truly resonate. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our State of the Bay page at kalw.org. Tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next is Not Born Yesterday, the show about the joys and challenges of aging. It explores the issues and opportunities of getting older with experts in the field. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.